Hey, Dave, what movie are we doing today?
Dude, we get to that when we actually get to the title and we talk about that.
It's just kind of weird. Hey, we're here to do Alien and stuff, but before we get to that, let's do some pod business.
Well, okay, we can go with that, but that was a little bit of milquetoast, dude, so why don't you own that if that's your direction here? Let's hear some gravitas to the voice. Hey, everybody, welcome to the DMC Movie Podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. What's going on, guys? Colin, how are you doing especially? I'd like to know.
Hello, Dave. I'm doing great.
Great.
How are you today?
I am not unwell. Marcus, what's up, dude?
I'm doing well, too.
Okay, you can decide to cut all that. All right, well, before we jump into today's film, just a couple quick follow-ups on The Gray Man. Colin, you mentioned during the podcast that you cannot watch just action movies for action's sake. And so I have a challenge for you on that one, which is I think you need to watch John Wick 4 and then report back your experience. Because
I plan to, actually.
Yeah.
No, I definitely will. Yeah, I'm curious because of the feedback that, you know, I've gotten from you about that movie and it being just pretty much just all action. So
yeah,
I'm interested to see what my take is as well.
Yeah, I'd be curious. So that's your homework assignment, Colin. Watch John Wick 4 and report back.
September 15th, I think. I'll be watching it.
Is that when it hits streaming somewhere?
It hits Stars? Yeah, Stars. Mm.
Is it good or bad? I hear it's just pure action.
Oh, no, I think it's really good. I mean, I thought pure it was very enjoyable. Well. Me and I saw it together. That was kind of fun. She came in. She's like, hey, Dad, do you want to go see John Wick 4? And I thought to myself, I raised my daughter right. Of course, let's go see John Wick 4. I think it's really good. It's fun, but it is very much stylized action versus, say, the first one and two, or the first two films in the series where there's a lot more, you know, kind of mythology being developed. This to me is just is pure action spectacle. So I'd be curious to see what you think.
Pure.
Well, now I'm not looking forward to it at all.
Well, that's good. Maybe if I set low expectations, you'll enjoy it more. Okay. Well, moving on to today's film, Colin.
What film is that?
You were nice enough to put together an introduction that you'd like me to try and read, which is quite the mouthful, but I'm going to go ahead and give it a shot.
I like run-on sentences.
This is definitely a run-on sentence. Okay, here we go.
I use the appropriate number of commas and pauses in there, so.
Okay, let's see how I do.
If you can't do it, I'll do it.
Okay. Today, we're here to discuss Ridley Scott's masterpiece of sci-fi horror, which spawned an iconic heroine, one of the best sequels of all time, maybe the best movie tagline ever, and brought Chestburster into the lexicon. Let's talk about 1979's Alien.
That was perfect, Dave. That sounded wonderful.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sunday, the Ridgely Theater in Fort Worth had the biggest day in its entire history. It sold more than The Godfather, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Superman, and Love Story. But the biggest surprise to theater employees is the number of parents bringing young children to see Alien. Did you know that this was an R-rated movie when you brought him?
Yes, we did.
Are you sorry you brought him?
Yes, I am.
Are you sorry, sir, that you brought your son along to see Alien?
No, ma'am, I think he should have seen it. It's something that he needs to know that things could like that could happen in life. That could be a true story.
So, Colin, you made this pick, and how did we get here, and why are we talking about Alien today?
Well, I personally love Alien as a movie. It's in, I think, my top 10, revolving top 10, that is, because I don't really keep a top 10 list, but it's up there. And I think pretty much, you know, the last couple of podcasts that we've done that weren't called The Gray Man, this movie's kind of come up, you know, with John Carpenter and The Thing, specifically The Thing and Marcus's take on Alien being, is it an 80s movie or is it a 70s movie? Or which one is 70s and which one's 80s? Marcus, can you elaborate
believe,
on that?
I believe Alien, I really like Alien because it reminds me of the 80s horror. So it's definitely a good...
Right. But you love The Thing because it reminds you of 70s of Alien, which is 70s horror.
70s horror. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, well, there you go. So I just decided, let's do it. I think it's time.
Good choice. Great pick. Yeah. I hadn't seen it in a long time, and so it was really, really fun to go back and rewatch and enjoy. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys, so when is the last time, how many times have you watched this movie over, say, the past, like, 25 years? Sorry, Marcus, I cut you off. Go for it.
No, it's all right. Like, probably only seen it a couple times. It's like that long. Like I haven't seen it that many times. It's not one I've rewatched a ton.
Yeah, how about you, Colin? I'm curious.
Oh, I've only seen it once. Probably maybe like 5 times. And every time I see it, I'm like, wow, this is such a great movie. And you know my love for Aliens. Every time I watch it, I'm just like,
Can I ask a clarifying question? You mean in general or specifically movie. The film Aliens?
The film Aliens.
Okay. Yes. Some weird cosplay going on there.
Take me to your leader. And so it's, you know, I find them to be different films. Like they're very different in terms of what they are, right? One's a really like an action war movie, Aliens, and this one's like sci-fi horror. And yet, God, there's just so many similarities. And so every time I watch Alien again, I'm like, wow, this is so great. And so it's just like moved up my list. And so even though I've only seen it probably like 5 times, man, it's just so good, right? It just feels like now when I watch it, it really feels like it is like the perfect like prequel to Aliens. Over the years, my love for it has grown.
Well, I was going to save this for opening questions, but I'll ask it now because if you were going to describe this movie in one word, what would that word be?
I don't know.
Marcus, do you have a word?
No.
One word, right?
Yeah.
One word. I know you have a word. Hyphenated. Why don't you tell us your word?
So I think it's craftsmanship. I mean, I think this movie...
That's not the word that I was thinking of.
Or artistry. I mean, you know, go for the two, right? I mean, because I think almost universally across the board with this movie, everything is pretty damn great, right? I mean, the interaction of the crew, the score, the photography, the sound design, the sets are just like off the charts, right? The special effects are amazing, great practical effects, by the way. And they got there using a lot of animal parts and stuff, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I was pretty blown away in watching this movie in terms of not seeing it for a long time. It's interesting because I was trying to, it's like, I've probably seen, let me ask you, Colin, how many times do you think you've seen Aliens in your life?
25, 30.
Right. Yeah. So I'm somewhere like in that same range too. And I think this is maybe only the third time I ever saw Alien. So, and I know kind of why.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I understand why actually. I have a very good understanding because I thought about it after watching the movie, which I can go into if you
I would love
curious.
To hear it. Or do we have to do another podcast?
No, no, it's not. We're not going too deep on this. But I guess what it comes down to is for whatever reason, I probably didn't see Alien until, you know, maybe I was like 12 or 13, saw it on VHS, I'm sure. And at that point, I'd already been chasing down all the scary horror shit and trying to find the grossest horror stuff. And so when I saw Alien as a young kid and I was watching it, I didn't appreciate all the great stuff that's in the movie. What I was looking for was the scary, gory monster stuff, right? And that stuff, I will say, I don't think that there's, truthfully, a ton of that in this movie. So for a movie called Alien, there's really not a lot of alien stuff in here. And certainly the suspense and the gore and the horror elements, I think, are overplayed, which, or you know, in terms of their supposed intensity, which we can talk about. But that's not really what impresses me about this movie. It's everything else. And so my appreciation for this movie is kind of, it's, you know, kind of across the board, honestly. But as a young kid looking at this, this would not have, you know, checked the boxes for me in terms of what I was looking for in a, quote, horror movie, right? So it wasn't something that I would have gone back and rewatched. And then once we hit Aliens, I told that story in, I think, our 1987 podcast. That was, I was on a first date with a girl that I was pretty interested in, and 10 minutes into the movie, I basically forgot I was on a date. Just watching Aliens, I was so into it, you know? Marcus was actually there. I forget who Marcus was with, but...
Oh, I didn't realize you guys were dating at that point.
No, it wasn't Marcus and I directly. It was a girl named Jenny, and we'll leave it at that. But then, you know, so then you go to Aliens, and then after that, Aliens was such a high watermark that the movies that came after that, because I think there's a chance that the three of us all saw Alien 3 together in Los Angeles, right? And that was probably a bit of a letdown at the time. And then Alien Resurrection is just weird. And at that point, you're like, eh, fuck the property. So I never really went back to watch Alien because at the time, I sort of, not dismissed it, but I was in my head, I'm like, eh, that's not really, you know, my kind of movie necessarily. But now being far removed forward and going back into it, I'm seriously impressed.
Yeah, I don't think I watched it. I probably didn't see Alien until after Aliens. I probably saw it like whenever, 86, 87. And so I saw Aliens first and be like, oh, got to see the prequel to it. I might have saw it before, but I don't think so. I don't remember. Like, maybe I saw scenes of it or something from my older brother.
Well, I would say that it is wonderfully atmospheric, and I will echo what you said, Dave. It is sort of master craftsmanship. Doing research into this and watching some of the behind the scenes documentary, I was not aware just how much really they thought about the story, how much went into the development of the story, but then how much like Ridley Scott really thought about it, how much he thought about the characters, and then how much they really, really thought about set design, the creature design, all of that. It really is impressive. I went into to seeing the movie the first time when I was probably like 10 or 11. You know, I saw it on VHS as well, but I'd been fascinated by the movie ever since it came out in 79, and I saw the poster.
Oh yeah.
And I was just like fascinated. Like, what is in that egg? What is going to come out of it? Where is it? Like, the, you know, sort of this like sort of this grid pattern of a landscape. Like, what is that? I was just like fascinated. And of course, the probably the most amazing movie tagline of all time, you know, in space, no one can hear your scream. I needed to know more. When I watched it, I was not really paying too much attention. You know, my expectation was that it was going to be a horror movie that happened to be set in space. And I love science fiction, but I was just like, what is this? And just watching it again and again, you pick up all the incredible detail and you read about it, and it's just, wow. Like, you're right. It's just the artistry that went into to building this. And of course, when Aliens came out, you know, it was a lot more about the action, but they really extended it. Like, they took that and they said, we're going to run with it. And so you see all of that artistry in Aliens as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think we were probably all at just the perfect age when Aliens hit.
I think that was
100% squarely in our wheelhouse of, you know, three teenage guys who want to see a fun, exciting, basically a war movie is what it is, right? I mean, like you said, but that definitely is something that was an experience. And so Alien, by comparison, much quieter, you know, more thoughtful. You have to kind of pick up on the details. And, you know, 15, 16 year old me, if I were to say like, oh, Alien versus Aliens, my quick reaction would be, fucking Aliens blows Alien out of the water. It's not even a comparison.
Yeah.
After watching Alien, I'm like, they're two different movies, right? You got to know what you're looking for. But the craftsmanship on display in Alien, I think, is crazy good. I was very impressed watching it.
Yeah, I mean, just they really are. They're two completely different movies set in the same universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One's like complete action, one's almost the Alien. The first one's like more of an art film. It is that kind of slow. It's a drama more than like, I wouldn't even classify it. Like, would you call it a horror now?
I do. Yeah, I still do. I mean, when you watch it, is it scary? No, because you know where the tension, what's going to happen, right? You know where the jump scare is. And so from that perspective, no, it doesn't scare. However, it has so many other things that are great that are going for it. And that's why I watch it. Now, it's not something I'm going to like rewatch every week, right? Whereas when I was a kid, or like even in my 20s, you know, I was watching Aliens like all the time.
Oh,
right.
For sure.
Yeah.
A ton of fun. Like, right. Like,
that's the difference. And I don't know that even at the time, Alien would have been a movie that probably teenagers would have hooked onto and rewatched again and again. I don't think necessarily that type of movie.
I think that was my experience too. I watched it, probably the first time I watched it was like 15, 16, when I like actually sat down and watched the whole thing. I'm like, yeah, kind of boring. Well, you know, it's like, so few Alien in this movie. Like, it's not like.
Well, I tell you what, if I were like 15 or 16 and I went to see Alien, I'm definitely going to go see it again on a date.
Oh, because you think she's going to jump into your lap?
The slow parts.
Yeah, rather than like, you know, you with Aliens and
versus me like,
ditching your date.
I'm just checking out. Like, I'm watching the movie. God damn it!
She's like trying to grab your hand. You're like, shut up!
Like, get off me! Get off me!
I'm watching this movie.
Is that the power loader? Okay. Well, so by general introduction, so it does have an IMDb rating of 8.5, and I think that's actually higher than Aliens. I was going to check that. Anybody happen to check that number?
No, I did not. Luckily, we have the internet.
Dave, you're right. Aliens is 8.4. So
yeah, that's
it. Got it by 0.1.
I'm not sure I would agree with that as a rating. I would still put Aliens as a better movie than Alien. Colin, let me ask you that straight up. Which is the better movie?
Wow. Well, I think you know. I mean, I like Aliens more. Yeah. But
preference. Maybe do you think one is better than the other? I guess would be a question.
I can't answer that.
All right.
I do like Alien better. I have it ranked higher. It moved up like 60 spots in my list. I had it down in the 90s after rewatching it. It's now up in the 30s, and I have it much higher than Aliens. I actually didn't even see Aliens on my list. It's there somewhere.
How does it compare to Paris, Texas?
Paris, Texas it's got it way beat. Paris, Texas right now is 22nd on the list. That's a good 11 ahead. Harry Dean Stanton. You got two in the top 50. Good old Harry Dean.
So from a financial standpoint, the film was definitely a big success. So made for a budget of $11 million. The total worldwide box office was $184 million. That included $62 million for the domestic box office and $122 million for the international. By the way, you know what's pretty interesting? So the worldwide Aliens box office was $183 million. So the two of them were within a million of each other. I was quite surprised by that. I would have thought that Aliens maybe was much bigger financial success, but they were very close, apparently.
That is surprising. Yeah, I would have guessed like... Nuts. Yeah, I would have guessed like 100 million. Aliens would have done 100 million more.
Yeah, no, me too. I was shocked by that, actually.
Well, you know, it could be the creative accounting by 20th Century Fox.
They don't want to pay off.
So this is really kind of crazy, because when the movie came out, when Alien came out, it was like an overnight success. I mean, it had like lines around the block at its premiere in Hollywood at the Egyptian Theater. And it was quite a spectacle. Like, it had like movie props and everything. Like that. They had the space jockey out in front of the theater. Somebody actually, it was such a sensation that somebody like burned it, and because they thought it was had to do with like the devil, right?
What?
I know, it's kind of crazy. Like some like religious nuts like decided to try to burn the props.
At least those are all gone now.
Yeah, right. So the movie was like a big success, and Fox, the studio, they claimed that it had a $2 million loss, even though it had made like up to like in its first run, like $180 million just in the US, right? And they're like, a $2 million loss? And so there was like a ton of criticism in the industry. And then so Fox sort of like bent to that, and they adjusted the profit to like $4 million, which... Yeah, I know. And everyone's like, oh, BS, right? And so Brandywine, who is the production company, they sued Fox. Fox claimed that Alien was not a financial success and did not warrant a sequel. And so they ended up settling out of the court like several years later. And Brandywine got Fox to agree to fund a sequel. I mean, can you believe that? The movie makes that much money, and they're trying to like pull one over.
What was everyone? Why? There's an advantage for a movie studio to say that we had a hit on our hands too. So what was the, do you know anything more about it? I'm curious.
No, but I assume that they're just like trying to screw the production company out of the money and like,
anyone
keep it all for themselves.
Yeah.
Well, so the one thing that's interesting about that is, do you know the original script for Alien had Ripley dying?
Yeah. I was going to talk about that at the end.
But which we can't talk about, but I'm just curious, because you say that they didn't want to fund a sequel, but as I understand it, the Fox executives stepped in and said, no, we can't have that as an ending, because we might want to continue this as a property, or we might want to set up a sequel. So that's interesting.
That's the irony, in that it was such a huge success.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the Hollywood studio accounting system for you.
Right. Well, critically, the film, I think it definitely got mixed reviews. So I scanned a bunch of different reviews, and it was somewhat polarizing. So I saw a couple of references saying that it was, you know, kind of low rent sci-fi, which I thought was kind of strange. And then I found a bunch of them that were very glowing. And Roger Ebert, for example, had 4 stars. He gave the film 4 stars, so his highest possible rating.
And there you go, Raj.
One thing in terms of, you know, our thing tie-in, so he starts off the review by saying, at its most fundamental level, Alien is a movie about things that can jump out of the dark and kill you. It shares a kinship with the shark in Jaws, Michael Myers in Halloween, and assorted spiders, snakes, tarantulas, and stalkers. Its most obvious influence is Howard Hawks' The Thing from 1951, which is also about a team on an isolated outpost who discover a long dormant alien, bring it inside, and are picked off one by one as it haunts the corridors. Look at that movie and you see Alien and Embryo. So I thought that was interesting.
And
for sure.
And why did we do Alien again? Because we did the thing. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and you know the other Carpenter tie-in for this, right?
Dark Star. That's our next movie, right? Dark Star.
Dan O'Bannon and Dark Star.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So you say that, you know, it got criticism because it was like low rent sci-fi, and I can see, I understand that. Like now, looking back, look at it from, you know, in the 1970s, you know, what was sci-fi? Well, a few years before, you had Star Wars, this like sort of grand, you know, science fiction saga. But before that, you had 2001, right? And we're talking about a movie, Alien, now that is like very purposely, you know, made to be about space truckers,
right?
You know, and it's all the sets are like very highly mechanical and dirty, and you know they're definitely going against type. They didn't want it to be some sort of like very pristine, bright, sterile environments. So I can understand it because I think some of these, you know, critics went in expecting one thing and not getting it. But then, of course, this has all been reassessed over time. And, it's considered one of the greatest and most influential sci-fi and horror films of all time. You know, this happens when you're sort of breaking new ground.
Right. Marcus?
Oh, no, I was just agreeing with Colin. I think that's what makes it so interesting now is it is not this over-glamorized sci-fi. It's not. Like it is looking at just like, this is just a working class group of people doing their job. And this is, you know, they're not anything special. They're not heroes. They're just like out there trying to make a living. And how would they react? And it makes it all the more realistic.
The other thing though, about reasons why it was met with criticism was because of the gore, effects, which there's not a lot of. But what it is, what they do have is very impactful.
And there's only one scene, basically. It's just the chest bursting scene. Yeah. I don't think anything else in this movie that's really gory at all. I mean, what you see the like a half second of the, you know, the appendage coming out of the mouth, right? And I forget who, maybe it's not Parker. I forget who it is who's on the receiving end of it, but
Kane.
Yeah. But otherwise, this movie is not a. It's not really a scary movie in my mind. That's the thing. It's
Oh no. This was a definitely a scary movie.
No, I'm saying for now, and it's interesting because I was talking to Bill Tiller, and I know he's going to listen to this pod. So Bill, we're looking for you for some alien feedback. But he tells a story where he went and saw the movie with his dad and his sister, and I think he was maybe 11 at the time. And after the chestburster scene, apparently his dad turned to them and said, "Hey, do you guys want to go?" And what Bill said is he recognized that his dad was scared. Awesome. But they stuck it out, and Alien is, you know, I imagine Alien's like a top five movie for Bill. So, Bill, yes, send us some feedback.
About the chestburster, I mean, look, this is the first time that had been done on screen. I mean, like we're used to that kind of gore today.
Yeah.
Audiences back then, they were not. And a lot of them responded quite poorly. I mean, people were like, running to the bathrooms and vomiting. There was like one during one of the previews, one of the ushers like fainted and like had a heart attack or something.
That's a bit of an extreme reaction to a movie. But okay. Well,
no, but people were like, they were seriously freaked out. Yeah. Others were just like, fuck yeah, this is amazing. Right. We're used to that stuff today. So I could see where, especially the critics at the time thinking that this is low rent because of that, but they're just looking at like one thing.
Yeah.
And that's it. And they're failing to see the rest of it. And that's why a lot of them went back and reassessed and changed their viewpoints later on.
Yeah, but it's interesting too, because the film did receive a lot of, you call it critical praise in the form of awards.
Yeah, I mean, look, the visual effects, it won the Academy Award in 1980 for best visual effects.
Yeah.
Just in terms of like the acting, John Hurt, he was nominated for a BAFTA for Best Supporting Actor. Veronica Cartwright, who plays Lambert, you know, she won Best Supporting Actress.
Oh, God! Saturn Award. Oh, God!
Oh, my God. I love Veronica Cartwright. Oh, my God. She plays hysterical better than any actress I know. She is just amazing. that was, I mean, look, it's a, it was ranked like seventh best sci-fi genre movie by the AFI in 2008. So it's a highly esteemed movie now.
Yeah, it is now. And what I think is interesting is the fact that it wins the Academy Award. So you have these people that are saying, oh, it's some, you know, low rent gross monster movie, but yeah, let's give him an Academy Award anyways, right? So it was definitely, even back then, pretty polarizing. But I would say, based on the awards it received and the accolades from people that were in the industry, I think it was pretty highly regarded.
For yes. Sure. Cool. One of the reasons I like Alien more than The Thing is the lower amount of gore and extra like practical effects. So I think they have the right amount, I think, in Alien. And that's where I think The Thing overdoes it some. And to compare the two, which I know we did last time, but that's definitely where I place Alien much higher up on that list.
So interesting question. Like, would we have had The Thing in 1982 if we didn't have Alien in 1979?
I don't think so. I mean, Alien also was like only got greenlit because of Star Wars did so well. Like, they're looking for a movie for like, okay, sci-fi is hot. What do we got? And the only script they had on the desk was Alien. Or maybe it was called Star
Definitely
Beast.
Not Star Wars.
but that was like how it ended up getting greenlit. They're like, okay, let's get this one going. Like, I think O'Bannon was trying to get it going since he did Dark Star, which was in 74. They wanted to do a more serious movie after that. And it took him a while to get greenlit. And it wasn't until Star Wars actually was a huge success. And like, we need something. Let's go.
Yeah, that is really actually pretty interesting about Dan O'Bannon, who wrote the story alongside Ronald Shusett. He had the story down, or at least the first like 20 minutes of the movie he had like down pat, and then brought in Ronald Shusett to help him finish it off. But yeah, he wanted to do this. He had done Dark Star with John Carpenter again, yep, who did The Thing, right? And yeah, he actually even starred in the movie, right? Because this was like a student film. It was like it was like the best student film ever, and like
the worst theatrical film.
The worst theatrical film ever. So like right on that border, right? Yeah, and so it was like a comedy, and they didn't have like a real alien, right? They had this beach ball.
Right.
And so he just really wanted to make like basically Dark Star, but as a serious movie with like a real alien. And that was like sort of the whole genesis for Alien.
You know, he's written a lot of movies that I really enjoy. Obviously, you guys know my love of Blue Thunder, which I have yet to rewatch since we did our 1980 podcast or whatever that was. But beside that, I mean, Life Force is a movie maybe we should do, because that movie is just straight up bonkers, right? I think it was originally called The Space Vampires, and that movie does benefit from Matilda May's presence throughout the film for sure. He actually wrote the script.
Especially when you're like 12 or 13 years old.
Exactly, yes. It was impactful at the time. He wrote a movie called Dead and Buried, which, you know, Marcus, we were talking about what is 80s horror. This is actually really, this is a very interesting early 80s horror film, and it's not a slasher. It has it actually does ramp the gore at the time in an interesting way. So it's kind of a classic 80s, you know, for people that are into horror, I would say it's up there for 80s horror. But then he also wrote Return of the Living Dead, which is a movie that I love. I have great passion for that movie. I think it's incredibly creative. It's funny. It's a great take on the whole zombie experience, and I think he crushed it. So that's definitely one of my favorite 80 movies. So I would consider myself an O'Bannon fan.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to be accused for not listening again, but did you mention Total Recall?
Oh, you had a note on Total Recall, so I thought you were going to go there.
Oh, God. Did not. Yeah. Well, he did Total Recall as well. He wrote that along with Ronald Shusett.
Yeah.
Which I did not... I did not recall that. Those are two like great things to have on your on your CV, right? Oh yeah. Yeah, we wrote Alien and Total Recall. That's fantastic.
Well, it's pretty fun to think about the fact that, okay, well, you know, O'Bannon was, you know, several of these movies have a decent amount of gore in them, and then you write Total Recall and you get Verhoeven as your director. That's a match made in heaven if you want some serious gore. Yeah. I would say that Total Recall is probably the goriest film on this entire list, if you remember that movie.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, listening to O'Bannon talk about this on the documentary, now I sort of realize, you know, like he definitely likes the low budget stuff. Like he really, he's just all of it. Alien is like too highbrow, really, for Dan O'Bannon. They didn't just write it. Like O'Bannon also brought in H.R. Giger and the guys who did all of the set design, like who, you know, had like these amazing like drawings, because they had worked together when O'Bannon was working on Jodorowsky's Dune adaptation, which of course never went anywhere. But he met who was it, Chris Foss, who was the concept artist, and H.R. Giger, and who, you know, as we all know, his work inspired.
He's got a screw loose. Is that what you're gonna say?
No, his work inspired. Like he basically designed the alien.
He has issues for sure.
There's some weird repressed sexuality there. Something's going on.
Giger is a just an amazing person. So Hans Rudi Giger, very weird Swiss artist. Yeah. Apparently apparently the rumor was that he had the skeleton of his dead fiance in his home. Like he kept her skeleton. God. Yeah.
That's weird.
People were like on the set, you know, so he did like not only the alien design, but he also did like a ton of the set design. That, you know, he did the stuff on the planetoid and the derelict spacecraft.
Yeah.
And anything around the whole alien life cycle. So this guy is like super weird.
I love I love O'Bannon's quote. Like I read a quote from him saying like when he first met Giger and saw his work, he found it like so disturbing, and he's like, I loved it.
Yeah,
he's like, yeah, I'm in.
like a beautiful nightmare.
Yeah, right?
And so he's like, I want to work with this guy. Like, you should work with this guy. And oh my god, yeah, he's. I think there were like everyone on the set thought he was just like just a total weirdo, except for you know O'Bannon and the producers and Chris Foss. They loved him.
If you're making a movie about an alien, maybe having a total weirdo in your stable is not the worst idea in the world. Okay, anything else on the writing?
Marcus, what was the original title?
Star Beast!
Yeah, Star Beast. I don't think this movie would be the same if they'd called it Star Beast.
Oh, one thing I wanted to add about Giger, though, if you do want to, I really want to go to that. There was two bars. He actually wanted to open up a bar in New York, but that never ended up happening. And I think one of the bars in Switzerland closed. But there is a bar complete with like chair designs, skeletons, like all this weird architecture and stuff, like all inside the bar. So it'd be kind of fine place to go get a glass of milk.
It's really odd how much like people are just like really drawn to his artwork. I mean, weird people, right? I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing alien design. Like the xenomorph is just.
Yeah,
there's a reason why there's been like 4 to 6 of these movies, right? Like,
if you're listening, do a search H.R. Giger, G-I-G-E-R, and look at his artwork. It's really cool. It's also really disturbing. And he made most of it like in the 60s and 70s, like, you know, 10, 20 years before Alien. So check it out. It's fun. It's fun to look at.
So, and then I know that Walter Hill was slated as a possible director. So I don't know in terms of the shift there from, because I think the studio was pushing for Hill, but I know he was a producer on the film. And so I don't know where Ridley Scott came in. Do you know the history on that one, Colin?
Yeah, the studio really wanted Hill to direct because he was one of the producers, but he was pretty busy. He wasn't comfortable with all these like heavy visual effects. And let's face it, he's not a sci-fi director, right? He's a director of tough guy movies.
Yeah, he's a grungy kind of you know, something in the streets, weird nasty shit kind of guy,
like Nick Nolte.
Right. I mean, look, if they got Nolte to play the alien, then it probably would have worked. And they just took it out of space, and they set it like a truck stop, you know, for real truckers, not space truckers. They're real truckers.
Angry Nick Nolte trying to attack. Trying to impregnate the truckers.
Yeah, so they reached out to...
that would be a movie.
That would be quite the movie. So they had seen Ridley Scott's The Duelists, which came out... No, 75?
74, I think.
74. Oh, I'm not sure. I actually watched The Duelists a couple weeks ago.
How was it?
Really good. Really good.
Let me ask you this. Have you seen the last duel that he made?
Yes.
And how was
also,
that?
Also really good, yeah. But the guy loves duels.
Which is the better duel movie?
Hard to say. They're very
in the duel of duel films. Which one is better?
Well, I really liked The Duelists a lot. It takes place in the Napoleonic Wars.
Oh, it's a period film. And you enjoyed it.
Well, the other one's a period film too. They're very different films.
Is it Ridley Scott doing Napoleon now too?
Yeah, so that's the whole thing. Like, Ridley Scott's really coming full circle. He's like, now he's just starting to repeat himself. He's doing Duels again.
Did I do this already?
And Napoleon. Yeah, it's like, he's like, you know, I really like the first film, the first theatrical film that I directed was about Napoleon and dueling. So I'll just make two movies out of that subject.
The Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon, though, is going to be interesting. I'm going to have to... It's probably going to take a few minutes to settle in for me.
I don't know. I mean, he's such a great actor that...
Oh, he's a great actor. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. I just...
He's a little tall for the role, but, you know.
I need anti-lifts. Work with giants. One of the things about set design, I'm really impressed with, like, the scale that he goes through for the set and just the building out of, like, what they went through to, like, build it and just make everything seem so realistic and grand. It's just pretty... The whole thing's pretty amazing.
You're right. You know, they, you know, the space jockey,
yeah,
right? The pilot and the derelict spacecraft, right? They call it the space jockey. They built that to scale, right? They knew they couldn't really sell the vision if they just did a miniature of it. Like, they needed to have the actors walking around it. And so they spent like $500,000 to build this thing on a real set. And they had to go to the studio and ask for more money, but they were like really, really adamant about it. And that's like an iconic piece of science fiction.
Yeah, it's so cool.
It works really well when they cut between what you have with the helmet cam visuals, which are some, you know, slightly distorted, and you're kind of seeing, you know, what's this? That's actually
doesn't. You mean like from the video feed, or
yeah, from the video feed, right? And then all of a sudden it cuts to like you see what they're seeing, but with perfect clarity, and they're moving around the space jockey and all that, and that's an example of the craftsmanship, right? I'm just like, wow, I'm pretty. You know, blown away at the scale, the level of detail on the model, and the fact that it's all practical effects, no stupid CGI. It just, all of it is actually super. And then, by the way, that the set design, it runs through this entire film, right? All of the interior of the Nostromo is amazing. Like, and the different areas, right? The medical bay, the way the medical bay is, you know, lit and clean and light. And then you have, you know, the places like when, you know, Brett's out and he's looking for the alien, and it's, you know, dark and wet and dank and all. It's just, there are different areas of the ship that actually are given so much character by just how they're designed. And then, of course, you have all the stuff that is, there's so much alien imagery on the walls of the ship in terms of the pipes, and particularly when they go down the derelict spaceship, of course, it's all like that. It has the same kind of, you know, the stylized, it's all done in the alien style. And so when you see that, it's also just a fun mechanism, right, in terms of camouflaging the alien itself, because you don't know where it is, right? So it raises the tension by, okay, is that an alien or not? And of course, at the end, when Ripley's on the shuttle, you see that directly because it's basically right there in front of her. But all of the set design is just, it's pretty great. And even like the graphics, like on the screens when they're landing the ship and all that kind of stuff, I don't know, I was just very impressed with it for 1979.
No, I totally agree. Also, like the room with Mother when they're going into the to talk to Mother.
Yeah, you mean when they enter the HAL pod?
That's exactly. I'm talking to HAL.
That's very but that's much like HAL.
It's a very strange room because it's very soft, and it's got like the like all the lights on the walls and like all this interconnected. And I think they're trying to make it like probably like a brain or something like that, like the neurons or something like that. But it's very like definitely a different space. It's kind of like they go from like the captain's chair where it's just this like kind of dirty, gritty workspace, like almost like you're driving a forklift station, to like, oh, now we're going into this brightly lit, lights everywhere, everything's clean, set to like talk to them. So it's very, very like kind of interesting. And they do it like all the time.
Yeah, and I think what really impressed me too is the individual set areas are, you know, designed to evoke a certain emotional response. Like, for example, the, you know, the opening scene with the crew around the table, and you know, it's so it's this, okay, this is a safe space, right? Because it's relatively well lit, they're all together, they're just doing kind of the normal, you know, bullshitting back and forth. It just seems like
very communal.
Communal. So it's, there's, you know, no You're tension eating. Or there's, you feel that it's a safe spot. And then so of course to have that be the spot where the chest burst happens is pretty great, right? Because you've already been introduced to it once, you know, this is a happy, safe spot, and then boom, the chest burster comes in at that exact moment. And so the contrast of having that happen in a spot that you've already, you know, quote unquote, identified as safe is, I think, super effective. And it all comes down to the way it's lit and the way the sets are designed. I could actually just watch this movie again and just be looking at the walls, honestly, of the spaceship and all that kind of stuff, because it's that impressive to me.
This is a movie I really would love to see, like, on, you know, in the theater, like on a big screen. It definitely would be. We'll have to keep our eye out if they ever do the Fathom events or whatever they're called. It'd be a fun one to see back in the theater.
Oh, definitely. Okay, anything you'd like to say about the music, Colin?
I thought it was really interesting because Jerry Goldsmith did the music, and the score is very, very subtle. It's a really nice score, but what was really interesting is that, like, the editing team, they put in a bunch of Goldsmith's, they put in a bunch of, like, kind of, like, what do you call it? Like, I don't want to say, like, filler, but, like, cues. They use, like, these Jerry Goldsmith's work in other films as sort of placeholders while he was composing the score. And they put that into the sort of, like, a rough cut, right? Well, they really liked those pieces, and then when he delivered his score, they kind of decided that they were going to change it up. Like, they didn't use his original main title piece. And so Ridley Scott asked him to rewrite it. And he did. And he kind of wrote it as, like, the obvious thing, weird and strange. And everybody loved it. And so they did that to him. And then they ended up just keeping in some of the clips that they pulled from his other movies. Those made it into the final theatrical version of the film, and he was not happy about it. Like, I saw some interviews with him, and he still is not happy that they did that to him, even though it was his own work,
right?
But it was not what he did for this movie. Yeah, he just kind of felt like there was some sort of disconnect between him and Ridley Scott, you know. And but, you know, what he has is great. If you have the 2003 re-release on Blu-ray, you can actually listen to the different versions along as you're watching the movie. You can watch it with the original theatrical piece or with Goldsmith's, like, original piece.
Oh, that's interesting.
I have not done it yet, but I'm definitely going to. That all being said, you know, he was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Original Score.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one thing that I think is interesting is, I think Jerry Goldsmith is a really good composer. I like a lot of his work. He did, by the way, Colin, he did the Rudy score. Some great music in that. So, tryouts.
Goldsmith for me is hit or miss, right? So he did the Star Trek the motion picture, which is really good.
It's great. You know? Yeah, it's a good score. Yeah.
He also did LA Confidential, supposedly. That's what's in my notes, but somehow that doesn't sound right. Is that right?
I don't know off the top of my head, actually. So.
Marcus, look it up. Marcus, get on the internet and look it up.
He's done it. Yep. 1997. LA Confidential. Conductor, okay. Score, producer.
So weird, but very different, you know. Very different from Alien.
Well, you know, one thing I'd say, though, it's interesting because I'd be curious to see that alternate version that you're talking about, because I think one of the strengths of this film is the fact that the score is underused. The minimalist score, I think, is one of the things that does a good job of creating the tense atmosphere. And the opening shots of them going through the hallways in Nostromo, and, you know, just there are some very, very, you hear more of the ship than you do in terms of any kind of, like, really musical cue. But I think that is really well done. And I actually think that if you had really kind of overbearing music, I think it would actually detract from the film. So I'd kind of be curious to see what the alternate version would be like.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with you. Because just think about, like, with Aliens and James Horner's score. I mean, we're talking about night and day.
That's in your face. I mean, the Alien score is absolutely, like, you know, the Colonial Marines going nuts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think the minimalism also works with, like, the tagline of Alien and, like, the quiet of space and having all of that, like, kind of there and knowing it. I think it works really well.
Yeah, but think about it too. Like, we're talking about, like, a single creature in the shadows hunting you down one by one. It's super tension filled, and it's not, like, blaring, right? It's quiet. Like I said, it's quiet. It's still, and you don't know what's going to happen next, and that just, like, builds that tension. Of course, the end of the movie, you've got, like, fucking complete chaos with the alarm klaxons going off and the countdown and all this stuff. We'll talk about the ending too. I've got some notes that I never even realized until I watched this movie again. I was like, holy shit.
Is that, at, you know, as a kid, I went to go see a movie in the theater. And so at the time, I guess I would have been 8 or 9. And the Alien poster was in the cabinet. And I remember walking up and just looking at the poster and almost being slightly afraid of the poster. Like, it unnerved me.
That's what I mean.
You mentioned it up front, but this awesome tagline, "In space, no one can hear you scream." That part of the marketing, I think, was just executed phenomenally. Like, that poster is iconic for sure.
Yeah. The poster, too. So they sort of like the egg that they used, it's actually a hen's egg on the poster. It's not the same egg, you know, from the movie. And I think it's because they, at the time, they didn't have like the design for the egg.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just sort of used this hen's egg as a stand-in. And then somehow it just like sort of like got left in on the poster. So you never see that egg. Like that egg really has nothing to do with the movie itself.
Yeah.
It's, you know, but it works beautifully.
By the way, one other quick note about the egg and the egg design. So Giger, apparently his initial design for the top of the egg was, not surprisingly, it was very vaginal in its design. So
yeah, not surprised.
And so so somebody on the Fox side asked them to actually change the egg so that when it opened, it was more of it folded back in four as opposed to just being a vagina, because I guess they were a little bit concerned with the amount of penis and vagina imagery that was just inherent in Giger's work.
There's a lot of it.
Penis and vagina. Speaking of penis and vagina, so Veronica Cartwright, she described Giger's sets as, quote, "so erotic. It's big vaginas and penises. The whole thing is like you're going inside some sort of womb or whatever. It's sort of visceral."
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, do you have a good understanding as to why this movie is so sexual in nature? Is there, do you have a, because I guess I didn't read, or in my research, I didn't find something that talked about Ridley's intent in that regard. And so I don't know how much of it was purposeful, how much of it was just absorbing some of Giger's designs, how much of it was, you know, kind of just inherent in the script. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, my thoughts are that it's all subtext. It's just what people read into it. Yes, Giger's work is very sexual, right?
I mean, this whole movie is very blatantly sexual in terms of themes.
I mean, it's all about procreation in the aliens. Like,
yeah, I mean, look, you've got
and sexual assault. I mean, there's a lot of sexual oral assault rape. Here.
You've got oral rape by the face alien,
right?
Yeah,
you have birth from the chest booster. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in fact, Ronald Shusett,
he calls it Kane's son at one point,
right? Yeah, alien. Ronald Shusett, he knew when writing this film that they had to sort of like to get like the alien like onto the ship, they had to do something that was completely different. Like, you know, thinking back to movies like The Thing from Another World, we need to do something different. So his idea was like, well, what if the alien screwed one of the humans,
right?
And then it would impregnate it. The human, and they would give birth by like having like come out of the stomach, you know, just burst out of its stomach. So this was always a theme. But aside from that, was it like supposed to be saying something? I don't know.
Yeah,
that's, a lot of people have interpreted. They've got their own interpretations. And honestly, my eyes kind of glazed over when I was reading through that stuff.
Yeah, no, that was my question, which is, I mean, it's obviously it can be interpreted however people want to interpret it, but how much of it was intentional? That was the question I had. I just don't know what the answer is there.
I think on the surface, it's intentional, but beyond that, I don't know.
All right, you guys ready to move on to cast?
Sure.
Let's do it.
So Tom Skerritt as Dallas. Let me ask you guys, just when you think of Tom Skerritt, what's the number one role that pops into your head?
Viper.
Top Gun.
Yeah, Viper from Top Gun. Me too. Yep. But Tom Skerritt is great here. Seems to be a pretty good captain. He's somewhat laid back, but he can be directive when he needs to. The one thing that's interesting here is that Harrison Ford, I guess, was offered the role and turned it down.
So it's interesting because I know that they always had Tom Skerritt in mind, but when it was a low budget movie, he really didn't want anything to do with it. Once they brought on Ridley Scott and Brandywine and they were putting money into it, then he was like, oh, okay, now I'll do it.
Yeah.
But I really do like him in this. These are the two films I really, you know, yes, Top Gun, but also Alien. The thing about his role in Alien is that when I saw this, when I was just like a kid, I just thought he looked like a 70s porn star. with that long hair and the beard. You know, it was just like, whoa.
Need to drop in a bass line here. Universally, the entire crew and their chemistry and how they act against each other and all that is great. Like, there's not a weak link in the bunch. John Hurt is Kane. So one thing I really do appreciate here is the fact that, you know, for the first part of the movie, you think John Hurt's going to be the hero. Then you think maybe Dallas is going to be the hero. And then, of course, it ends up with, you know, Sigourney Weaver. Ripley, obviously, is the, not, I wouldn't call her a final girl in this, but last one standing.
She's definitely a final girl.
Kind of is, except she's not that. She's like super strong.
Yeah. She's not, I don't know.
But I will say, like, you know, at the end when she's trying to make her way back to the shuttle and the alien's in her way, like, she, there's very, very strong final girl vibes there.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Now, I totally agree. I think it's a very clever, because John Hurt was probably the most popular actor at this time. Like, it's kind of ruined because we know Ripley's the main character. So yeah. I don't think I ever saw it not knowing that. But it'd be kind of interesting if you could go back and somehow watch it without knowing that she was, you know, maybe I'll get Alzheimer's and when I get old, like, rewatch it and enjoy it.
Well, I did. Like, as a kid, I remember, I didn't think she was going to be the survivor. I know maybe Dave, you did, because you were like all into horror movies and slasher movies and that's what happens. But she was an unknown at the time. You know, she just came from like the stage and she was a lot younger than everyone else. And they didn't particularly, the rest of the cast didn't particularly respect her that much because she was inexperienced and there was like a lot of tension on the set, particularly around her. And in fact, they didn't think that she was doing that great early on. And then she and Yaphet Kotto, they'd argue a lot between scenes. And he was like pretty brutal pushing her, but she responded by being very forceful as, you know, like their commander.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that. Like, I love the scenes where Parker and Brett are just giving her shit early on, you know, when they're making repairs.
Yeah.
And you could tell there's some like serious sparks going on between those characters and between the actors. So I think it's really, really cool.
Well, what's interesting about that is I read that Ridley Scott actually gave Yaphet Kotto direction to, you know, off screen specifically stir up shit with Sigourney Weaver, like try to actually push her buttons, that he was giving, like he gave that direction to Yaphet Kotto to just like poke her. So that,
oh, interesting. I could see that. Yeah. Well, she responded.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think she's great. The other thing that's interesting about the Sigourney Weaver role is apparently Meryl Streep was considered.
I can't see her in this. No, I can't see her doing this. I feel like she would have wilted, you know.
It's funny that you say that, because I was going to say, I'm like, I'm not sure that she would be, or she would project as much strength as Sigourney Weaver does in the movie. So that's the one thing that I think where it'd be interesting. And speaking of, by the way, the projecting strength or lack thereof, so Veronica Cartwright as Lambert, and apparently she was not very happy with the way that her character was written in the film, and I guess they talked to her and said, well, you are the... you're filling in for the audience. You are showing your terror and you are representing the audience and what they should be feeling. Because she thought her character was too weak as the film went on.
Sure. Well, she initially also came in auditioning for the Ripley role. And when she got it, she didn't know she didn't have the role until she started like suiting up and they were like giving her a costume. And it's like, wait, I'm not Lampert. Ripley.
Why does my coverall say Lambert on it?
Yeah,
I know, right? That's
she was like on purpose. They kind of did that to her. Yeah, playing games.
Nice, playing games.
Yeah,
Lambert's emotionally weak. She just wants to get the fuck out of there. Like, you know, just in an instant. Like, she's like, oh, it's all going to shit. Like, I'm not staying on the ship.
Yeah,
and she just like she loses it like immediately. And Veronica Cartwright is just amazing at crying on cue and playing hysterical. Like, have you ever seen her in like The Witches of Eastwick?
Yeah.
She's just
a long time ago.
Oh my God. She just like, she's amazing. Like her eyes are always like red and welling with tears. And she's just like, sort of like out of her mind. She's really wonderful at that. When I heard that she didn't like her character's emotional weakness, I was just like, why? You're so good at it.
He doesn't want to be pigeonholed.
Yeah, well, she has the best reaction, obviously, during the chestburster sequence. And apparently, there's a myth that the crew didn't, or the actors didn't know what was going to happen. They knew something was going to happen. I guess what they understood was that the thing emerges, or there was some sort of that was the direction that was actually included in the script. So John Hurt was obviously in on the situation because of the way that he was positioned at the table. So they put the prosthetic on top of him. But what they didn't know is that they were going to spray the amount of blood that was going to come out of his body. There's a quote from Sigourney Weaver where she says, you know, we got on the set and we looked around and everybody else, like all the people that were behind the camera were wearing raincoats. She's like, that probably should have been an indication that something was going to happen.
That's great. That scene's like so good. Yeah. Like,
You watch that scene and just, you know, you've seen it a million times, but forget about looking at the chestburster. Just look at the rest of the crew see the looks on their faces. And it is like genuine surprise. And you're right. She loses it. She like falls to the floor.
Veronica Cartwright's the best part of the scene, probably. Like, she's like, she makes the scene what it is. Like, her reaction to it is amazing.
Oh, God. Freaks out.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful scene. It's a wonderful scene.
Just delightful.
Just heartwarming. So you have Ian Holm as Ash, and man, this guy is just in this movie. He is one creepy motherfucker. Let me say that. And what was so funny about this is I was trying to think back, okay, what did I really remember about Alien before rewatching it? Because I probably hadn't watched this movie for like, I don't know, 25 years, 20 years, something like that. And the main thing that I remembered was Ash going, that's a perfect what I remember, because I was so grossed out by that scene. That was probably the most disgusting scene in the movie for me personally, was the white fluid coming out of his mouth. Like, none of the alien stuff or even the chest burster. Nope, it was the damn android. That's what flipped me out. Right.
And all the white, milky white liquid that's just like dried on his face.
Yeah.
And he's just like, it's gurgling out of his mouth. It's disgusting.
It is disgusting.
It's so disgusting. And it was really shocking when he's like kind of like losing control and they're fighting him. And then Parker takes a fire extinguisher and just like slams it into the side of his head. And his head comes off.
Yeah.
And then I think that's actually the moment where that usher fainted.
really?
It was, because he wasn't thinking like, oh my God, the guy's head came off. Right. It was a shocking scene.
The one thing I was thinking about, and it's impossible to do this now, but I was kind of curious. I mean, you know, at this point, because of the alien mythology and Bishop in particular in Aliens, and then you even have, I think her name is Call, I think in Alien Resurrection, there's another android. But
wait, are we talking about who are we talking about? Who is Call? Is that like, that wasn't Noni, is it?
Yeah, it's someone on a writer. She's an android. She's a synthetic
Ash, Bishop,
person.
Call, David.
But I was, and then you have David and Prometheus and Alien Covenant. But I was kind of curious about if you watch this movie and you don't have that perspective, and all of a sudden this android dude shows up and you were seeing it for the first time, is that just totally out of left field and weird, or is it sort of acceptable within this reality? Because for me, it's like, you know, he's an android already. You know, you have the Bishop experience, et cetera. So it's already part of my mental picture of this movie. I was trying to imagine if that would have been a big jarring moment if you were seeing this for the first time in 1979, and if there was enough there to justify it, I guess that was my question.
Look,
I think it would be very, like, because that's one of the surprises too. You didn't know he was a android until, I think even the crew didn't know he was an android until then, right?
Right.
Yeah. I remember the first time I watched it, and no, it was like, I had no clue what was going on. You see like the little like line, I thought it looked like sweat, but it's actually white.
It's like milky color.
I call it milk too. It's not, but it's like, yeah, this milky white. You're like, what is going on? And I had no clue. It wasn't until they knocked his head off that I had any idea that the guy was an android. I thought he was like seriously like freaking out.
Right.
So yeah, that's all just so shocking.
It's a total left field moment. So I'm just wondering, would it be too distracting or difficult for the audience to understand? It's like, what? There's an android. It's like, what's an android doing here? Or how could they make the thing?
But they talk about it, that he was a synthetic and that the company sent
synthetic. That's after the fact, after the reveal. So it's fine. It was more of a curiosity.
like, was there any foreshadowing that he was a synthetic?
He did that thing with the knife, right?
So. I don't see it because I didn't see it. Maybe that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, he did the thing with the knife. Yeah. No, no. And that was the whole thing. Yeah. Like, that's why it was such a huge surprise. All we knew is that, you know, we were thinking as the audience that, well, he's a company man, you know, and he's there.
Replaced right
he's sort of end. Like the political officer on the Red October. Like, right. He's there to make sure that, you know, everything goes according to the company's plans, right? No one, that's why everyone's so like shocked and surprised, the crew, that he was synthetic.
Yeah, he's a creepy motherfucker in this movie. That's
he is. He's fantastic.
Oh, by the way, quick question here, just even though we're going through cast, why does David stay awake if he's an android, and then versus like Bishop and this guy going into stasis?
Because they wanted to fool him. The crew didn't know he was
that's a good answer for the alien one, but
Well, is, you mean like in Prometheus, why does David stay awake?
Right.
He just learning. He was like learning all about humans. Yeah, he was perfecting his...
psychosis?
His what was he?
Wait, was he playing basketball?
Like basketball.
Basketball on a unicycle.
Yeah.
Is that what he was doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
He's got to get in his threes.
So you have Yaphet Kotto as Parker, and I'm just a huge Yaphet Kotto fan. I really am. I love Yaphet Kotto in anything I've ever seen him in. So
Lieutenant Al Giadello.
It could be a police drama. It could be Midnight Run. It could be this film. Doesn't matter. Love me some Yaphet Kotto.
He's my favorite in the movie too.
Yeah, seriously. Like, you know, aside from Sigourney Weaver, who is like the MVP, he's like right there. Like if he wasn't there, I don't think it would have worked as well. Like he has the gravitas in this movie. He's so wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. In some respects, he's almost the leader, right? It's like he flirts with that position a little bit in terms of particularly when they go on the alien hunt, etc.
So he would be like MacReady in the thing if they didn't have a real leader, right?
Right.
Like that, he'd step up.
Yeah.
Except he would have stepped up and said like, okay, we're leaving. We're going. I want my bonus.
Yeah. Can I get a bonus?
Share. Yeah. Always harping on the bonuses. I love it. Yeah. He's just such in the first, you know, half of the movie. He's just complaining all the time.
Yeah.
It's what keeps like it very realistic. And, yeah.
It's like, you know, he'd be like the guy who is trying to start a union, except there's only one other guy to join, Brett.
Yeah, speaking of Brett, so actually one last Yaphet Kotto question. So I did notice on the credits that they gave him an and Yaphet Kotto, which I was surprised when they were showing the cast. I was just kind of curious about that because, you know, he'd been in a couple of films like Live and Let Die. But I was kind of wondering if they did that based on his performance in the film in terms of the, you know, kind of the gravitas, like you were saying, that he adds to it. Or because I was thinking about somebody like, you know, versus say John Hurt, right? Which I would almost think that John Hurt would be the one with the and John Hurt at the end of it. So I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. I couldn't find anything about in the credits as to why that was the case.
Well, I do have a question about John Hurt at that time, because like, what was he like really famous for at that time? But we can come back to that.
He was just nominated for an Oscar.
For what?
Midnight Express, 1978.
Oh, okay. Anything else that was major before that?
He's been in a bunch, but not yeah.
Hey, you know,
whatever. Everyone's got a couple of those.
I think it was that they wanted him, you know, because he was, you know, he had been in Live and Let Die, and he was a great villain in that.
John Hurt or Yaphet Kotto?
No, Yaphet Kotto.
Can you please keep us informed on where you are in your progression?
Sorry, going back.
The listeners may forget.
Okay, going back to Yaphet, and. So supposedly he said that he had rejected a very lucrative film offer in the hope of being cast. So I feel like he used that as leverage to get the role, but also to like maybe get a little higher status. Well, I got this other movie and they're going to pay me a ton of money, but I'll do your movie, but you got to give me an and.
You got to throw me an and?
You got to throw me an and.
Yeah. Yeah. I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, John Hurt's been in like 40 credits prior to this movie. He's definitely the best well-known actor before this.
Okay, yeah. I mean,
for not a lot I've seen, but like he's been making movies since 62. So
yeah, well, you know, look, when I saw this movie, like everyone was new to me. I don't think I'd seen any of these actors, and I really did not think. I thought Sigourney Weaver is just like this young woman. You know, I thought anyone else was going to be the hero of this movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I was, you know, as a kid, pleasantly surprised.
That's cool. So Harry Dean Stanton plays Brett. Harry Dean Stanton, as far as I can tell, much like Wilford Brimley in The Thing, he just hit a certain age and then stayed there. He's like one of those guys that
he came out as a 42-year-old man.
He's been 42 for about 30 years, somewhere right around there. I love Harry Dean Stanton though. Almost in anything I see him in, like his sort of laconic delivery. I'm not sure how you want to define it. Just kind of casual, and you know, I think about him in Repo Man, of course. Think about him at the fence in Red Dawn. So I like Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah, he's great.
When he auditioned for this movie, his first words to Ridley Scott were, "I don't like sci-fi or monster movies." So Ridley Scott sort of had to convince him. He said it would be a thriller.
Yeah,
it was thrilling.
It's a thriller with alien. It's set in space. So
yeah. All I gotta say, if you had Ronald Shusett give him a summary of what the movie was about, he'd been like, "Yeah, I'm leaving."
Yeah, hard pass. So then you actually have his name is, I think, Balaji Badeo. Is that how you pronounce it?
Sure.
Okay. So he plays the alien, and actually he was just found in a bar in England because he's close. He's almost 7 feet tall. And it's pretty interesting to see him in the suit. And you can go to YouTube and find several test sequences where he's just wearing the alien head and he's walking around. I don't know if you guys happen to see it, but it's pretty cool looking. It's pretty creepy. And so he's trying different alien walks, like wearing that oversized head. And he's kind of going through the hallway of the ship, and they have him kind of creep around the corner, and it's pretty fun to see. But I mean, it's kind of cool. It's like some dude's in a bar. It's like, hey, you want to be the alien? Yeah, sure. What the hell?
Yeah, and the reason that they noticed him was because they were having this trouble with the suit, because it just looked like a guy in a suit, right?
Yeah.
And what they really wanted was like to have these really like thin, almost like insectoid like arms and legs, and they couldn't do it because all the stuntmen or whatever, they were like normal, like, you know, normal human appendages, and so it looked like a guy in a suit. And then the casting director saw this guy in the bar, and he was perfect because he was like so thin. His arms are really thin, his legs are really thin, and so when he got into the suit, he just looked inhuman, and it was because he was so slim. And of course, he's 7 feet tall. Great, great stuff. I like the fact that you really don't see the alien full on, like the whole body, until the very end.
Right.
Because I don't think it would have worked very well.
Yeah. There was actually a spot at the end too where it did look like a guy in a suit.
It kind of did. And
yeah,
and
I'm so, like, ooh, that doesn't. Yeah. That no, didn't
I,
age I well.
We might have the same note at the end there when we talk about.
Yeah. One part where I'm just like, ooh, that's noticeable.
Yeah.
I think one of the very best shots in this movie is like right towards the end where the alien is confronting Lambert and Parker. And you just see this like very short, like maybe 3/4 of a second shot of the alien from the side, sort of like you see its arms and you see it sort of like moving forward. And it's such an amazing shot. And you see the whole like sort of like the bony appendages off the back. And you see the whole like side view of the head and kind of the hands. And it's just like so creepy and yet artistic and beautiful at the same time. I'm like, Giger's nuts. He's totally nuts. And there's a reason this all works. Why people, they think the xenomorph is just so amazing.
And then moving on to the final member of the crew, Jonesy, which was actually played by four different cats. By the way, I love the reason that they had four different cats, because I think I saw the description. One was good for holding, and then I think the one was good for running, and then at least two were good for being scared.
Yeah. Specialists.
So hissing, they were the hissing specialists. And I do love the fact that the way they got Jonesy to hiss was that they brought in a German Shepherd who was, I guess, a relatively friendly dog. He liked cats, but they would walk him up and they would have a barrier they put between the cat and the dog, and then they would pull the barrier up really quickly and the dog would be there and the cat would see the dog and it would hiss, and they would have the camera focused on the cat. So that's how they got the hisses in the movie. They brought in a German Shepherd for some not proper, I guess, he was for some chemistry read. So. Wow.
That's pretty great.
That's funny.
You gotta love the animal wranglers. They didn't think that they could just like lower the alien head down. I think most cats would probably be like, what the fuck is that?
Nope, they had to bring in a German Shepherd. All right, Marcus, do you want to hit us with a plot summary? Not that probably people are confused as to what this movie's about, but based on the title, but go for it.
On their return to Earth, a mining crew pick up an unknown signal. They investigate and discover an alien life form that they reluctantly bring aboard the ship, making the journey home a terrifying nightmare.
Okay. All right, opening questions.
I've got one for you, Dave.
Okay.
Did this movie start your disgust of milk? Did it start with this film?
It certainly didn't help it. I will say that I went up to my parents a couple weeks ago, and we sat down at dinner, and my dad had a glass of milk, and it kind of freaked me out. So, yeah, milk is gross.
Why do you think milk is gross?
It's just disgusting.
Why is it disgusting?
Because mammals should not be drinking milk past those early weaning years. We're not designed for it, and it just grosses me out.
Well, all right. You live in a farming community, right?
Yeah, I do, sort of. You know, maybe it really did gross me out, because again, what I told you before we started watching this, all I could remember was Ian Holm. Perfect organism.
Well, there you go.
So yeah, apparently that's what really scared me. Okay, I have a question, which is, do you think Ripley and Dallas are supposed to be having some kind of a relationship in this movie?
I don't think so, but I think maybe at the time I thought there would be, only because I think that's what I was expecting, you know, from there's a male lead and a female lead, you know, naturally they'll be having sex, and I believe the answer is no.
And as a kid, you were desperately hoping for that?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Ripley does get down to her skivvies at the end of the movie. And I think that was the first time I'd ever seen a woman in underwear that small. In fact, I think in the future, they were like, the underwear is going to be extremely small.
Made an impact, huh?
It made an impact, yes.
Well, you know why I say that, which I, after again not watching this for a long time, there are a couple of scenes, like one is where, you know, she's talking to Dallas about the science officer and, you know, do you trust him, that sort of thing, and the energy that's going back and forth between the two of them. It seems they're very familiar with each other is what it feels like. And then apparently in the original script, there was a sex scene between Dallas and Ripley. Then they didn't even end up shooting it. So they pulled it content-wise before they started making the movie. But I just thought that was interesting.
It wouldn't have added anything. As far as closeness goes, I feel like this is a very tight-knit crew. Like, you can tell because there's a lot of tension between everyone. And it's not, I don't know if I'd call it tension, but it's like this mild annoyance, right? It's like these people have worked together for a long time.
Right.
And they're tired and they just want to like go home, get their shares, go home before their next multi-month journey out.
Yep.
And so they know each other like intimately well. I wouldn't be surprised if they had sex at some point. You know, that's what you do when you're a space trucker. But
you're bored out in space.
I'm glad they didn't. I don't think it would have added anything.
Oh, I certainly don't think it was necessary, and I'm in no way advocating for it. I just thought it was interesting that I just felt like there were a couple of scenes where the energy between Ripley and Dallas may have reflected that earlier version of the script. But by the way, one thing that's interesting is that Ripley was originally in the script a male character. And when they brought Sigourney Weaver
That would have been weird.
Yeah. Well, when they brought Sigourney Weaver in for the role, they didn't change any of the dialogue, which I thought was interesting. So that, I guess when the script was written, all the names were purposely intended to be somewhat unisex. And so you could kind of plug anybody into the role. And so but for whatever reason, they ended up going from, male to female.
That's interesting about the dialogue, you know, it's not written for a woman. It's just written like as if it's a man.
Right.
And that's one of the things where her character is just, she's strong. She doesn't take any bullshit. She's in command, you know, when they're down at the spacecraft, you know, she's in command of the Nostromo. And of course, Ash completely disobeys her order. And she's like, if you think about it, she's the only like real sane one on that ship.
Right.
Yeah, it just would have felt so out of place if they had done it. And that's one of the things that makes this character so interesting and made her this ultimately this iconic character.
Well, yeah, and I also think that not having a couple in place sort of paired up, I think is a better dynamic, right? Because it's kind of, it's everybody against the alien versus it's like, okay, there's a sub-click or something like that, right? Where someone's going to go back and save the person they might love or whatever versus somebody else. So
yeah, which has been cliche. It would have been cliche.
Yeah, no, and so I think it works much better the way that it is.
Yeah.
Okay, I have one more question, which is, does the alien consume inorganic matter to increase mass? How does it go from being 5 inches tall to...
It's a great question.
7 feet tall in... what appears to be, you know, what, an hour? Hours, maybe?
Yeah.
The answer is Viagra.
No, that's good. But I am also curious about, you know, what's the thought there? Because they do talk about what you hear on the ship is that things that they thought were fixed are suddenly breaking again. You hear like some back and forth between Parker and Brett about that. So I was kind of wondering, is the alien chewing through a bunch of shit because it's increasing its own mass and that's what's breaking things in the ship? Because otherwise, I'm not sure how you explain the dramatic increase in size, because I'm not sure that
not
the laws of matter and physics will support that.
Well, I thought that, you know, it was just that Brett was a shitty engineer, and that's why stuff kept breaking.
That's a good pickup if it did break for that. That's a good...
I think this is like the age-old question, you know, like how does such a small creature get so big so quickly? And I'm not going to try to answer that question. I think it's just like, you know, it's
part of the... It's an alien.
It's genetic engineering. It was engineered to be a weapon. And so somehow that's what it does. You know, it just grows inside it. Grows in size incredibly quickly.
Yeah, it might have like a very dense, like, matter that you can't...
I was just curious. And then one
of the... Just add water and it grows.
Yeah.
It's like a shrinky dink.
Yeah. I'm sure maybe there's moisture in the air.
It's not a shrinking
moisture inside of Kane.
The sea monkeys.
Okay, here's another question I've always had about this movie.
Yeah.
Why was it raining on the Nostromo?
Yeah, that one's weird.
So I assume that was condensation. Like that's where I was going.
It's a lot of condensation that coming down. Like, I thought something
broke. It's basically like raining.
Yeah.
There's like a light rain going on in this cargo hold. By the way, it just amps up that scene. It's wonderful. I love it. You got like water dripping off these chains and they're like slowly jingling and jangling. And it's like, it's so eerie.
You can hear the alien in that scene too. You can hear the alien before it appears. You can hear the breathing, which I think is pretty interesting.
Oh, really? Oh, I did not hear it, but maybe I should have done it with like...
Watch it with headphones.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can hear
it. I'll watch it with headphones.
Okay, I'm sorry. I have one last question, then we'll close out my questions, which is, how is Ridley Scott the same guy who directed Prometheus and Alien Covenant as the guy who directed this movie? What the fuck happened?
Marcus, you want to take a stab at this one?
40 years? I don't know.
Yeah, the main thing for me, what I was saying is like, how could it be the same guy, is that, you know, Alien seems super tight, really well thought out. You know, every single scene, every single shot seems well planned. And the character actions, for the most part, are pretty believable, right? With the exception of maybe, you know, Kane sticking his face over the egg. I don't know why aliens always scientists always have a desire in these movies to, when they see something bad, their idea is, let me just get my face as close to it as possible. I don't really understand. Like, that must be in a manual somewhere.
At least Kane wasn't a scientist.
But I mean, honestly, Prometheus and Covenant are lazy and somewhat sloppy by comparison in terms of the stupidity of those scripts, right? It's just, so that's the thing that's frustrating to me, because I mean, Ridley Scott's obviously an amazing talent, and so just spend a little more time on the writing and make a better movie, because I think both Prometheus and Alien Covenant have huge problems, and I don't think either one of those are particularly good movies.
I'm going to blame Fox. They seem like they've just screwed up this whole franchise somehow, so they've just been bad actors the whole way, so I'm just going to blame the studio.
They've only made two of your favorite movies of all time. But...
True. I'm not saying that I don't like them. I'm just saying that, you know, I feel like in this case, they're not to be trusted.
All right, I have a question.
Okay, go.
You want to keep going?
Yeah.
I'm going to end that conversation. You have more to say?
Yeah. No, please, no, go.
All right. The so for the end, like the space mining transport ship, right? It's just a transport mining ore, turning it. Why does it have a self-destruct sequence? Why is there a self-destruct? Why is there one? Why is it also so complicated? Like the override takes 5 minutes. You can't override it in the last 5 minutes. Like I do not understand the one. Why do they have it? Two, why is it so complex? Why is there no override? I have a lot of questions about who designed that system.
I sort of like this image in my mind of like, you know, like Zaz, you know, the Zucker, Abram Zucker parodying this movie, having a scene where you like you go to the self-destruct and it's like in case of alien self-destruct, you know, it's a good question. There's got to be some sort of reason for it. The ore that you're mining is gonna fall into enemy hands. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't
it's
really
very
know.
Strange.
But I will tell you, this whole self-destruct sequence, which I'll let you go into, Marcus, is something that I uniquely and vividly remember watching the first time and thinking it was so freaking cool, this whole lengthy process and how not just lengthy, but how intricate it was. And watching every time I see her do this, not only like arming it, but then trying to disarm it by going backwards.
Yeah.
Like it's to me, it's some sort of like self-destruct sequence ASMR.
Yeah. But there's something like that whole process too. It's just like, why does it have to be so complicated?
Well, let me,
like,
can I jump in here? Cause it's funny. Cause I had the exact same question about the self-destruct thing. And I saw that you had it as there as well. So I went back and I actually I freeze framed the movie and I got the instructions that she has to follow for the self-destruct just really quickly, okay? So punch nuclear bolt code number 1, verify bolt clamp release, perform insertion of bolt number 1 to hole number 1, remove nuclear head, activate push button switch, replace nuclear head, verify secured, verify detonation activated, repeat for holds 2, 3, and 4. So this is my question. And then the last one I had, which was myself, was just like, shit your pants because it's taking too long. But if you're arming one nuclear bomb, why do you need to do it for 2, 3, and 4? Is one nuke not going to be enough to take out the ship?
I do not know.
Yeah.
All I know is this. It just ramps up the tension because you're sitting there going like, oh my God, like this alien could be on you like any second. And you're like sitting there out in the open doing this thing. And it's like, come on, is it done already? Is it done already? And
this
you got,
is the...
You got the alarm klaxons going off, and you got
the steam,
countdown.
The steam.
The steam, like, being spit out everywhere. It is wonderful. It is... Like,
it's definitely a great tense scene, for sure. But
I don't get tense watching it now, but I remember watching it the first time, and I was, like, sweating bullets.
Yeah.
It actually leads me to all... connected to your question, Colin, is the or just like user interface designers at Weyland Yutani just terrible? Is that what it comes down to?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, but it just seems like something like an engineer would come up with.
Yeah. Overly complicated.
So speaking of Weyland Yutani, Colin, you had a question about them?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, number one, I think we've established the fact that they might be like the worst company ever to work for, but just like how much did they know beforehand and how did they come across the information? Because they clearly directed the ship there.
Right.
Like, they brought it out of whatever.
Yeah, but they heard the signal. So I don't think they knew until they heard the signal.
Yeah, but they knew something was there because they...
Well, they heard a signal.
No. I mean that the company had a directive to bring it back.
Yeah.
Whatever it was. Do you mean that they heard the signal and then like they relayed information after they like brought it back on board and they
They because they were coming home and they dropped out of whatever hyperspace, whatever they call it, and they were because they had picked up a distress signal or some sort of signal.
Yeah.
And so that's when they dropped them out of that and they went to go investigate it. And I think at that point Weyland Yutani knew, okay, there's a signal there and they're going to, I think the suspicious stuff, That's like the storyline, and then they go investigate. And I think once Weyland Yutani
we know why they dropped out of hyperspace and got and came out.
But
of
I don't think they knew from my initial viewing. I don't think they knew that there was something there, but they just have like a standing order. If like, hey, if you find anything cool out there, bring it home and we can make it as a weapon.
Well, I think the main question that I had on that was, you know, the fact that the science officer was replaced.
That's exactly
before they left. So I think both right in terms of the ship met those conditions, but the question was, did they know the ship was they were going to meet those conditions? And then my question on that one is, if that's the case, why not, like, why do you just let them complete their ore pickup?
Yeah. Send them all the way out to get the ore and come all the way back.
It's going to take a long time. Like, if you really, really are desperate to get that. And then, of course, that actually dovetails to another question that I think Marcus had.
Wasn't it 10 months?
What is the status of alien life in this universe at this point? Because the fact that they discover it and they say, you know, is the signal, you know, human, and they're like unknown or whatever, kind of gets back to very similar to like what happens in The Thing, right? Where you find this alien spaceship buried in the ice. How come people aren't just freaking out and telling everybody like, we found aliens? So I'm curious to know what the status of alien life is in this universe. Have we found it someplace? Have we run into it?
I think so. And I think maybe
primordial shit, is that what you're thinking?
Organic matter elsewhere?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But probably not other, like, it's not like they ran into the Vulcans, you know. There's just like other organic life out there. And I feel like maybe what happened was, you know, they picked up this ore somewhere in like some other system, right? And it's that point where the company swapped out the science officer. So it was on the return trip. Because maybe they, like some other crew, ran into this.
There's like a mining colony there or something like that.
Some other crew out in deep space ran into this distress signal and like went down, and they got some bit of information, but like that whole crew was killed or something like that. And so now the company's like, okay, now we're going to send this crew because they're on their way. They're going to pass through that system, and we're going to replace the science officer. And his directive is to get a specimen back no matter what, you know, crew is expendable. And so they knew more going in, and they knew ahead of time. But the question is just how much information did they have ahead of time? They knew something was important there, and they wanted it. And it wasn't just from them, like, you know, hearing this distress signal. They knew something else before that.
Do you think it was the space jockey's like battery on the distress signal? Like, they're powering that signal for a while. Like, how long has that been going?
What's the battery life on the space jockey? Yeah.
Well, then, Colin, you had another question, which is Weyland-Yutani the worst corporation in the history of mankind?
Oh, they're definitely worse than Comcast.
I had a few up here. So Comcast comes to mind. Ticketmaster was another one that jumped to mind. And then you have to get to, like, you know, you start to go really bad, like Union Carbide. Remember the disaster? Mall. And then, you know, you could extend that to IG Farben, right? And their role in World War II. And then, of course, Autodesk is the last one I had on that list. That's just for personal reasons.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Any more opening questions you guys want to?
I do have one more if you want to talk about the cat.
Okay.
Do they have special like chiroseep for cats? Do they have a special like machine that can just like go in there as it is? And
Jonesy ends up in the pod with Ripley at the end, right?
Yeah.
So just if you're sleeping in the pod, you're good. Like all you have to do is sleep in there, and it's fine.
I guess so. That's what it seemed like. Yeah.
That's it. And there's a litter box on board. Who's like changing it? Is it all like Ripley? Like it's her cat.
I actually had a question about like the animal policy and then also smoking on the ship.
Yeah.
Lots of smoking going on. I'm not sure that there'd be as much smoking today.
I think I sent you guys this still, that there was this picture of like baby Jonesy in like in Ripley's like workstation. She had like next to her equipment. So it's kind of, it does show that it probably was her cat.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like the crew cat, but she obviously has the close connection because that was my other question. Do you go back for Jonesy? Well, she obviously did.
Yeah.
So that's my question. Like, because I'm pretty sure, you know, like, would I go back for Zelda? Yes, but I'd be really terrified. I mean, and the first sign of the alien, I'm like, sorry, Zelda, you're on your own.
Yeah, I would not go back for Jonesy, but I would go back for my cat Milo, who's also an orange cat. Strap on some flamethrowers, whatever. I'm going for it, man. I'm getting my cat.
These fucking cats, man. These cats. Well, I had one more question, which was
poor Jonesy in the box getting like thrown around all over the place. He was not happy.
He had a bit of a rough ride.
Actually, two-part question. My first question was Ripley justified in destroying the Nostromo? And I think we can all agree that...
I don't think so.
I think she was, because...
Why? The alien was on the shuttle anyway, so it did no good. Pointless.
She blew up all that ore?
Yeah,
but she didn't know that.
That's 200 million tons of ore, Colin. Do you know what that fetches on the open market?
He just fucked up. He just fucked up Parker's bonus too. I mean,
so
look, well, okay. I know it's an emotional period, but this is a multi-billion-dollar installation, right? You just can't be blowing it up, right?
Fuck it, we're gonna nuke it for more. But look, when I wrote that question down, it was like probably midway through, and I'm like, was she really justified in doing that? And then we get to Ash and his little escapades. And at that point, I'm like, yeah, they were. She was totally justified, because the company was, they were going to, you know, the crew was expendable.
Well, why not just escape, though, in the shuttle and not blow up the Nostromo? Because at that point, they said, hey, you know, you think we were lying about this alien. Go ahead and go back and take a look yourself. Like, it's right there.
No, but they want it. You'd be releasing, because the ship's going to Earth, so you'd be releasing the alien either as a weapon for Weyland Yutani, or like the alien would be attacking Earth.
Well, no, I mean, I understand the implications, I guess, if you keep the alien alive, but
yeah,
it also just seems like a way where they could easily just cover their ass in terms of why they had to leave the ship, right? It's like, hey, you guys don't believe me? Go ahead and crawl in there. Have fun.
It wouldn't have been as fun, but
as blowing up the ship.
Look,
Do you know every crew member has been wanting to press the nuke panel as soon as they found out the ship had a self-destruct button? They're like,
maybe that's why it's so complicated.
Let's figure this out. Exactly. Let's create a scenario where somebody gets to push that damn button, man. Come on, let's do it.
They're like, look, Parker and Brett complaining endlessly about their shares. Like, let's make it really difficult. We don't want somebody getting drunk in the middle of the night and pressing the button.
No, that's true, actually.
Stir crazy.
I still think, especially when I watched the movie as a kid, like, there just seemed like there's no way you're going to kill this alien on your own.
Yeah.
And what if this thing like starts to multiply? Like, we're all doomed, right? So I think she was justified, especially because the company was fucked up. But I wonder if they had to go through all of this anyway. Like, they could have just left. You know, Lambert was the one who was saying, she was actually pleading with the crew.
And then don't blame the others. Oh, no, you're out of your mind.
You got a better idea?
Yes. I say that we abandon the ship. We get the shuttle and just get the hell out of here. We take our chances and just hope that somebody picks us up.
The shuttle won't take four.
Well, then why don't we trust Russ?
I'm not going any straws. I'm for killing that goddamn thing right now.
Okay.
To just abandon ship in the shuttle, and they nixed it because it only supported like four, and there was five of them, right? Because by that point, Kane and Dallas were dead, right? So they couldn't do it because they had five people. But in hindsight, who was the fifth person? Ash, the synthetic. Had they known that, they would have gone.
Hmm.
Yeah, of course, Ash would have just like killed them all at that point,
right?
But. They could have gone. They could have just gone.
All right. Anything else on the opening questions, or should we want to jump into this and talk about a few key scenes?
Yeah, it's only been like 2 hours. So let's dive deep now.
Okay. Well, let's really get into it now. Just a couple things about the opening. I'll just say that the title sequence and the credit sequence in this film is pretty amazing. Like, I think it's really well done. The slow fade into the name Alien. It's and the score and the backdrop of the planets. It's super creepy. It's really, really well done. I just think the opening credit sequence sets the tone for this movie really amazingly well.
Yeah.
I totally agree. And then I think the next shot you get is the sort of the beauty pass underneath the Nostromo.
Which is very similar to the Star Destroyer in Star Wars, sure. Right? I mean, I was
thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah. So there's a lot of homage being paid there. And then the other thing is that we mentioned this, but just I think the interaction of the actors, like I'm so curious to know kind of what the instruction was, because we talk about them being space truckers and all that, but just as a general kind of, you know, sort of panning around the table and seeing characters interact with each other, this is probably the most natural you know, acting or believable set of characters I've seen in a movie in a long time. So I just totally bought into who all these people are.
Yeah, for sure. The actors all have great chemistry.
Yeah.
And like I said before, they seem like they're a family. Like they've worked together for a long time. They also have like little petty grievances and shit like that. But yeah, they just all seem like super comfortable and each one knows their job. And yeah, they get around the table and they're laughing and smoking and eating. I think they use the same containers as Lars Owen.
The Star Wars containers, right?
Yes. I was expecting to see some blue milk.
Some blue milk, yeah.
Yeah. Apparently they saved it for Ash.
I do love, by the way, that they have Jonesy sitting at the table eating with them. I love that. That's pretty cool.
Oh, I think I missed that.
Yeah, Jonesy's actually a member of the crew sitting at the table eating some cat food along with them.
Nice.
So I like that. One of the things I just really like about this movie is it gives you enough time for them to land the ship. Like, I think it's really cool. I mean, I think this whole movie is super impressive. The fact that you don't see the alien until 56 minutes into it. I mean, that's a pretty long time to go. And during all that time, they're doing all this great setup and character building and all that. But just the fact that it's not like, hey, we're just going to zoom in and drop the ship. And like they kind of did in Prometheus, by the way. No, it's hard, right? They fuck it up. They break a few things when they landed. It's a hard thing to do. Everybody's a little tense about it. I just think that that's a more realistic way to show a ship landing in a movie like this. So I think it's pretty well done.
Yeah. And I thought it was really cool too. Like just the arm extending and all of that. Like they take their time with the whole thing. Yeah. And lots of countdown. Lots of countdown.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Some countdowns.
And the lights look very eerie.
The lights. Oh, the landing lights. They put the floodlights on. Lights. Yeah, there's something. Yeah. I love that visual. Actually, it's
they
really cool.
They look like Christmas lights or something because they're not like in a straight line. You know, it seems like they've been messed around with over the years.
Yeah. So where Kane goes down and finds the, I don't know what you want to call it, like an egg field. The laser that they had there was they borrowed it from the Who, the band the Who, and that's how they created the effect because they were looking to do something. They were trying to figure out if they're going to build a barrier or how they were going to separate the eggs. And they ended up putting this, you know, laser across the smoke. And they thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. But I do have a question, which is who actually built that thing? And what is the purpose
of the egg chamber or the laser?
The laser.
Who built the laser?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean, I don't know. It's just probably part of the ship.
No, because it's set up as like a warning or some sort of an alert that, you know, when he crosses the barrier and puts his hand down into it. But if you assume that the derelict ship is full of space jockeys that were eaten and killed off, it's unlikely that one of them went down and set up a laser to say, hey, don't go down here, right? It's just very confusing as to...
Look, maybe the space jockeys, as you refer to them, maybe they were having a rave before the aliens got loose.
Well, that's
kill them all.
That's a possibility, I guess. We'll go with that. Okay. Rave. Thank you, Colin, for answering that question.
They were at a rave. Yeah, apparently the Who was like next in the soundstage next door.
Yeah,
like practicing like visual effects for their tour.
Yeah,
and that's how they got it. It's just such a fun story.
That's pretty cool actually. And then one other thing that I noticed for the first time for sure, which is the so when he goes down and looks at the egg and there's the reverse gravity, so the egg is sweating upwards, which I just thought was kind of strange. Like it's a definitely a bit of an unnerving effect, but I hadn't noticed that until this first time or last time I saw it, I guess.
Yeah, I it's not one of the things I had remembered either, but then so they filmed that upside down to get that effect.
Oh, they didn't invent reverse gravity.
No, it's just really interesting just to see how they made that whole scene with the egg.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting, because I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then I wasn't sure if I saw it right the first time. So then I jumped back and watched it again. I'm like, yeah, that's definitely going in reverse. And then I guess what Ridley Scott said was they just did it to, kind of destabilize the audience a little bit, right? So to knock them off guard in terms of like, oh, what the hell's going on? Just, you know, introduce some uncertainty. So that was the point of doing it.
That's kind of cool. Just so cool that he thinks about so much of that stuff, dude. Just as, you know.
Craftsmanship, dude. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah, so just a couple other things. So I think that one of the places where the effects are a little weak is where, so after the face hugger comes off Kane, and they're looking for it, and all of a sudden, you know, it comes down behind Ripley. It really does feel that somebody's just above her wiggling it, like with their hand. Like, that's a little bit of a that's not the best effects moment in the film, let me say that.
No. But you are looking for that
jump scare.
Thank you.
Yeah. I get why you do it. I think that the effect inside the egg when Kane looks at it, and then when they have the image of the face hugger when it's attached to his face, and they go to try and pry it off, and you see it tighten up around his neck. Yeah. Just the movement of that. I mean, that thing looks so real.
It looks real. Yeah.
It looks absolutely 100% real. I mean, it's one of the best practical effects I've ever seen, honestly. I mean, it's so impressive.
It really is. Yeah. You know, his throat is like sweating and glistening, and you can see him breathing, and then you see the tail like tighten around it. I don't know how they did that. It really does look real.
And apparently the face hugger design was used, or for some of the shots, they use real animal parts, including, you know, like crustaceans, that smells so bad that people were vomiting on the set when they had to work with it. And I guess the inside of the egg, when Kane's looking at it, that I think is a combination of, I think, some sheep intestines and something else. And then it's actually like Ridley Scott's hand is in there moving it around. Like, he actually wanted to do it. So
when you see it, like the light up against the egg, and it's like fluttering. Yeah. That's just his hands. He's like sort of like waving his hands back and forth.
Yeah. But both that effect and when the face hugger is on him in the med bay, I'm just like, wow, man, that is like, to this day, look at that. Yeah. I'm like, that is some great shit effects wise. It's very impressive.
Cutting into the face hugger and then having this acid spill onto the floor. So it's basically has acid for blood.
It's a wonderful defense mechanism.
Right. Exactly. And they came up with that idea because they needed something. Cause I guess somebody kept saying something like, well, why don't they just shoot it, right, to kill the alien? Well, you can't do that because it'll splatter like acid everywhere.
Right.
Very creative. Yeah, extremely creative.
I guess Ron Cobb is the conceptual artist that came up with the idea to solve that problem, because Dan O'Bannon himself could not come up with a reason why they couldn't shoot the alien. So
that's pretty cool.
Good problem solving from a script writing standpoint.
Yeah, seriously.
One other thing that it's interesting, because just watching this movie closer, a bunch of little things I noticed. So when so Parker is, you know, getting ready to attack the chest burster when it comes out, and Ash stops him. So you actually get the sense that, you know, Ash is obviously working or, you know, for the alien in some respects throughout the movie. But I didn't know. I was like, oh, okay, I see. He's, you know, he says not to do it, or he says don't touch it, or I forget exactly what he says, but that's a good indication right there. If you want to kind of backtrack and say, okay, well, you know, when does Ash start going off the rails or whatever? And obviously that's even earlier in the film when he's looking at the, you know, the face hugger with Kane and all that.
I thought that might've been because of the acid blood or something, like, if he killed it, it's going to like burn through.
That's what I mean. I think maybe that's the excuse for it, but
yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay. You see all these little subtle clues of the way Ash is working on behalf of the alien, that it's, you know, once you know kind of where he is or what his character's role is, you're like, oh, okay, I get it.
Well, and then, I mean, even earlier
the chest burster scene,
the quarantine,
just bringing Kane on board. Yeah.
Right.
Breaking quarantine.
Yeah. Well, that was the, like,
yeah. I just think it's interesting. It's one of those things where, again, me watching it when I was a lot younger and looking for the monster shit, just not really paying attention to what the characters are doing. I'm like, oh no. Okay. You can see that Ash is definitely a bad guy all the way through the movie.
Right.
He has a set of motivations that are guiding him to do unethical shit. And he's going to stick with it.
It's kind of fun to like watch it as an adult, and like you pick up on all these things. And when you're a kid, you're like, yeah, you're just like,
where's the monster?
Well, that's just what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you're not thinking about motivations. Yeah. No. Where's the monster?
Yeah. So once the creature's out and about, like one thing, this is where, you know, maybe I disagree with, I don't know, kind of the public at large, but, you know, lots of people have said that the Dallas scene inside the air duct with the alien coming in on him is, you know, super, super tense and scary. I don't actually think that's the case. I think that the geography of the scene is too confusing to build the proper amount of tension. Like, I'm not sure, you're not sure exactly where Dallas is. You're not really sure in relation to where the alien is, which way it might be coming. I get that it's intended to be purposefully disorienting potentially, because he's just in a bunch of ducks. But
yeah, but
I didn't think that was a particularly tense scene personally.
I don't know. You had Cartwright or what's her name, Lampert, like calling out. You had the beeping was getting closer. You had the little like the GPS or whatever that's called. Like, I think it gave you enough sense. You didn't have to know exactly where it was and where it was coming from. I think that's part of it. We knew it kept getting closer and closer and closer. I don't know. I thought it was a great scene.
Oh, God, it's moving right towards you. Move, get out of there. Move, move,
No, I agree. I agree with Marcus.
I think it's a good scene. I just don't think that it's, I don't think it's as tense as people have made it out to be, I guess.
I think the first time I saw it, it was super tense. Yeah, there's confusion. Like that totally adds to it because now they don't know like exactly like where he is. Like, is it up? Is it down? Is it like from the side? Which side? And you don't really know. And then, you've got Lambert who's like, again, like panicking. going to pieces.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, the beeping and it's beeping and it's
beeping and flashing.
It's just ramping up the tension. And then, yeah. And then you get the jump scare.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's okay. I'm glad it scared you guys.
The first time I saw it.
The first time you saw it, yes. Okay.
It's still a good scene. Like, I don't know. I like it.
You pretty much take any movie. Like, I love Halloween. It's a classic, but it doesn't scare me anymore.
Well, actually, so that's, it's interesting you say that because I can watch the scene of Laurie walking across the street to go into the darkened house, which for me, I think is probably the all-time most suspenseful scene I've ever seen on film. And that still gets me, I still think it's tense. Like, it still kind of has an effect on me. Yes, I'm mentally damaged because of all the Halloween shit. Yes, I get that. and that definitely helps. But, I still think that it's, I think that's an example of a really well done suspenseful scene. And I don't know. The one in Alien, that one just doesn't track for me as an all-timer, I guess is what it comes down to.
Okay, Dave.
Yeah. and then my last question is really around, so do we assume that Ash is malfunctioning or he somehow, I don't know what, blows a circuit before he starts attacking Ripley? Is that what's happening to him?
Sorry, just looking at my title for this section. Ash goes nuts and throws a milk party. I don't, this has always been a question that I had. Like, what brought that on? Was he damaged in some way? Is there some sort of like competing like logic going on in his programming that's causing him to sort of lose it? I don't know how to answer the question.
So by the way, I did a little bit of research on this and I didn't find the original quote. Somebody referenced that Ridley Scott's talking about this in the director's cut. I don't know if this is true or not, but they were saying that's like it's the ultimate example of sexual frustration that Ash is exercising, because basically like he attempts to forcibly create the equivalent of fellatio by jamming a porn magazine down Ripley's mouth in the weirdest attack ever on film. By
I was
the way.
Gonna say, like, it's so strange, such a weird way to try to kill someone.
I don't even know what the hell it would like. Oh no, don't put a magazine on my mouth, right? So it's just very strange. but they were saying that maybe it's the fact that because he's an android, he doesn't have a penis and he's really sexually frustrated because of that. So I don't know if there's anything remotely close to that. I mean, that sounds like bullshit to me, but there's so much other sexual imagery and themes throughout this movie. I mean, I don't know, maybe there's something there, but.
I wouldn't be surprised, but I agree. There was a very weird way to attack her. It seemed strange. I did not remember that at all. And I'm just like, what? Like a magazine in the mouth?
He tried to jam his stuff into her and then he went and then he blew his head off and blew white liquid everywhere. Are you trying to say that that's somehow sexual?
Can you tell me more as to why you think it is? What are you referencing?
This is all really interesting. I just don't know. Like you could say yes.
I'm just saying I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
I don't know.
I have no idea.
I also just like don't know like why he sort of short-circuited. I wonder if he was short-circuiting from the get-go, because there's before they where they go down onto the planet's surface, there's that scene where he's sort of like getting ready to like guide everyone, and he like stands and runs in place like real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, well, is he doing that to sort of like prime himself, or is he doing that to sort of like
maybe shock the system because he's starting
knock out the kinks? So like, yeah. I don't know. Does he start like kind of like, you know, does he start twitching or something like elsewhere in the movie? I don't know. Also don't know why did they get into a fight beforehand? And that's why the fluid was like dripping down his forehead.
Well, that's why I assumed that maybe he was starting to, you know, freak out or break down or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's always confusing. Been
one of my questions. Yeah. I just don't know.
But the attack with the magazine is dumb. I mean, that's not the most, because you know, he has super strength, right? Doesn't he? I mean,
if he's definitely stronger.
One of the Bishop models, so he could just, you know, grab her and that'd be it. But
I'm sure there's something else besides a magazine in the medical bay too that he could use. Maybe like a knife.
Yeah. Scalpel. That'd be a good idea.
Yeah.
So personally, before that fight ensues, I love when, you know, Ripley is, she's, you know, talking to Mother, and she, you know, she gets the news that, you know, this is like that they're actually there to collect the specimen.
No, it's a specimen now, dude.
it's really late. It's been a long day. They're there to collect the specimen. The crew is expendable, and she sort of like leans back and throws her head back in disbelief. And there, right behind her, is Ash.
Yeah.
It's a really great shot.
Yeah. And it's creepy. I mean,
it's very creepy, and you're like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. It's like, I just learned that he's one of them, and then boom, he's right there.
Right.
Yeah. Really cool.
Okay, I just have a couple last questions about the ending. How did Jonesy get in the locker? Who put Jonesy in the locker?
I think Jonesy jumped into the locker to hide, and the door probably slammed behind him. Slam shut. That's it.
I don't know. I have to go back and look at those lockers to see if that's possible. What locker model are we talking about here, Colin?
It's the 2187.
Okay. Well, actually, that one makes sense. Thank you. And then just one last thing, which maybe this is where Marcus was referencing it, but there is a pretty rough effect of the alien dangling out of the shuttle at the end. It's just, It looks like a toy on a string sort of circling around. It's not the best effects moment in the movie, and it's kind of unfortunate that it happens at the very end when you're waiting for the big reveal and to see the alien and all that kind of stuff. I mean, the full-size alien looks mostly okay. There's a little bit of a man in suit moment there, but when it's hanging outside the shuttle, I don't think it looks particularly good. I think it's probably the worst effect in the movie. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would, especially when you compare it to the end of Aliens and you see the queen, like, you know, being blast out the airlock.
Yeah.
And it looks like a real like alien.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like a man in a suit. Watching the end of this movie again seemed very familiar. And what I realized, and
maybe you've seen the movie before?
No, it's just like, and maybe this is like the, you know, after, you know, 30 years or whatever of seeing this movie and Alien so many times, maybe it's just dawning on me now, but it's the exact same. Aliens has the exact same ending as Alien. All the beats and everything.
Yeah.
Ripley's trying to escape, right? She goes, and so an alien. So she's trying to escape, right? She goes back for her loved one, you know,
Newt.
Jonesy,
Newt.
The place is about to blow up, right? The processing plant, the Nostromo. Right. There's this incessant countdown. She makes it out just in time to see the whole thing blow up, right? The thermonuclear detonation. And then she's in the ship, about to relax, and bam, there's an alien stowaway, which she then blows out the ship. Then
she not only that, but she actually gets into a suit, right? So she puts on the power loader in Aliens, and she gets into the spacesuit. Yep,
there you go.
Alien.
It's the exact, like, Aliens did the exact same thing as Alien, and I never noticed it until like...
Are you fucking serious, dude? I mean, I thought it was totally intentional in Aliens. I thought that was, you know, that was the...
I think because I hadn't seen it, like, Alien in so long that I didn't remember. And so then I'm watching Alien, and I'm going, wait a minute, this is really, really... This is like beat for beat.
That was the one thing about when we walked out of Aliens. I remember, I was probably ignoring my date at the time, but I talking to Marcus or something, and I was like, oh man, it's the same. I talked about it like as we were exiting the theater because I was so surprised that they copied it so directly.
Oh yeah. I don't think I ever picked up on it.
That's interesting.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, Maybe. Why is it just now that this is all dawning on me?
This podcast is worth it.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this briefly, but the original script had the alien getting back on board the shuttle and decapitating Ripley. And then that was how the movie was going to end.
Oh, is that what happened? Okay, so yeah, I knew that, what was it? Like, he came up with the idea of a fourth act. And then, the original ending was just that, I wrote these notes like 3 weeks ago, okay? This is how long it's taken us to actually do this podcast. But so the original ending was Ripley escapes in the shuttlecraft and blows it in the Nostromo. Boom, it's over, right? Mm-hmm. So then Ridley Scott says, no, we're going to do this fourth act where then the alien stows away on the shuttle and she and Ripley's got to confront it. And he pitched it to the studio just to get additional budget and they went for it. But he wanted the alien to bite off Ripley's head and then make the final log entry in her voice. And they vetoed that, which was, you know, a good idea because it's really kind of a dumb idea.
Oh, that's pretty dumb, actually.
Yeah. Can you imagine just like, wait, how does this alien know? How can it mimic her voice? I mean, we've all seen like some movie that does that where it was like, you just roll your eyes. So thank God they didn't do that. But
Terminator.
Oh, how awful would that have been if like Ripley dies? I mean, it would have been shocking, certainly. But then you'd never get aliens.
I was like, they would have fucked up the plot of Aliens big time.
Yeah. You think?
A little bit.
Well, Meryl Streep could have been an alien.
Well, you could. or you could just I don't know, start a sequel where you kill off several of the major characters in an accident as it enters the atmosphere.
But just think about that, like the whole idea, and which I thought was wonderful when Aliens came, it was like, oh, wait a minute. So like I just blew up this whole ship to try to kill this alien and save myself. And like, I'm the lone survivor. There's no way to kill this thing other than apparently a nuclear explosion. And now you want me to go back and there's more of them. I mean, that the whole idea. I just love that. It's like,
yeah, no effing way.
You're like, you know, Roy Scheider, Chief Brody. And like, you want me to go out? And there's like a whole fleet of these sharks. and you want me to get in the water with them?
Yeah. Hard pass.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay on the beach. So by the way, the only other thing that I wanted to point out from a trivia standpoint, and this has to do with aliens, is apparently, and I didn't realize this, but when they're cutting through the door in Aliens, you actually see the harpoon gun like wedged into the bottom of the door.
And like, I've never seen it. Yeah.
And I think that's pretty cool. I mean, that's a pretty great attention to detail, James Cameron. So.
Oh yeah.
Really well done. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So I might go back and watch the opening scene of Aliens just to see that, just because I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, Aliens was also a Brandywine production.
Yeah. So you mentioned, even though there was no profit from the original Alien, so why make a sequel? See that? Closed looped it.
Profit?
Remember you had that whole diatribe about Fox and accounting?
Oh, sorry. I thought you said there wasn't a profit. like a prophet, like a messiah. Like,
has this podcast gone on so long that you forgot where we started? Sorry.
I you know, my brain only goes back 40 minutes.
It's, yeah, like, that's fine. I understand.
Over 2 hours ago.
Okay.
Man, it's, like I said, it's been a long day.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Marcus, let me answer this first. What did you learn from this movie?
I learned, regardless of the offer, promise of bonuses, don't ever apply for a job at Weyland-Yutani.
Colin, what did you learn from this?
When your first thought to resolve a dire situation is to nuke something, go with your gut.
Yeah, I have a slightly tangential one to that one, which is make sure you give yourself an additional 15 to 20 minutes to figure out the self-destruct sequence because, you know, it's not just going to be three people talking to the computer as you see in Star Trek. Apparently, you got to move things around. You got to do nuclear one. You got to do it four times. So just give yourself some time so that you're not panicked. You can just, you know, relax and enjoy the experience of getting the ship ready to blow up.
Hey, at least they had instructions.
Yeah, they did, actually.
And we got to hear them.
Yeah, very helpful. Okay, so Marcus, closing thoughts and letter grade.
Closing thoughts. Excellent movie. One of my favorite. Really good sci-fi. It's not as, I wouldn't classify it as horror quite as much anymore after watching it. I think it's a very good thriller. Really enjoyable. The dedication, as Dave has said many times, to craft. And just the sets and the scenery and just the whole aesthetic and the kind of quiet approach to it. They really won't make films like this anymore. Like there's no dialogue in the first 7 minutes of the movie. Like, it takes them that long to even get going, and you won't really see that. So definitely a pleasant pleasant surprise with that regard, with compared to how movies are made now, and just really, really enjoyable. And my letter grade is a solid A.
Colin?
It's da bomb. everything that Marcus just said, it's just a fantastic movie. So many details. You could just, you know, you could just live in all the behind the scenes stuff, all the set design. It's just like they put so much effort into creating this universe that they literally then created a whole universe for that with a number of sequels. It's just a great, like, it is, I think, the best sci-fi horror movie of all time. And while it may not be super scary anymore, the first time you see this movie, I you're going to be frightened.
It's, at some point, I'll try to show it to Mia just to see what her reaction is, but I'm not
sure. Did she see Aliens? I forgot.
No, she hasn't seen Aliens.
Okay. You got to see what she thinks about this movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll hopefully you'll give it a shot.
She's not familiar with the Xenomorph.
No. And again, I mentioned that you'd be surprised how little kids want to jump back into late 70s cinema, as I said on the last podcast.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. We were just talking about this today. Yeah. Like, there's kids need to have like built-in points in the movie to check their phones.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I'm giving it an A, obviously.
Come for the sets and the acting and the sound design and just the atmosphere creation, and stay for the alien. That's kind of my take on this, right? I mean, I think I just love looking at this movie. It's kind of, that was actually probably my frustration with Prometheus, by the way, is Prometheus is visually spectacular, but man, that is a fucking stupid movie compared to this one. And this one is smart and tight, and I appreciate it. And I love the slow burn, and so appreciate the slow burn on this movie. Like 56 minutes until the alien shows up is great. I mean, and it's all very captivating while you're watching it. So it's a straight A for me.
Colin, did you give it a letter grade?
We all gave it an A.
Okay. I was wondering if it made your A+.
I don't like to give out A pluses.
Strict Raider?
I think the only movie I'm getting A plus, there's two movies I'll give an A plus to.
Raiders?
Yeah.
And?
No guesses?
Bringing Up Baby?
Bringing Up Baby?
No. Good one. Good guess, though. No. No. Pulp Fiction.
Ah.
Don't put raspberries at Pulp Fiction.
Oh, then maybe give raspberries.
Might give it a B+.
All right, ready to wrap this thing, Colin? You got some editing to do.
Oh, I can't edit this. There's just no way. It's just not happening. We're just going to put this right on the shelf.
Well, good luck to you then. All right.
Coming to you in 2024.
Okay, I'm just going to fucking wrap this then. So
ship it as is. No editing needed. Good luck.
Seriously. Insert your own clips, people.
All right. So we hope you enjoyed our conversation about Alien, which we all agree is a pretty awesome movie, and we are highly complimentary to. And some of us learn to appreciate it in different ways. And I'm just going to leave it with that because Colin has close to 3 hours of raw audio to edit. So with that, we'll say this is the DMC Movie Podcast, signing off. Goodbye, everybody. You know, I want to talk about the bonus situation.
Okay. Yeah, as soon as we make money, you'll get your bonus.
Exactly. Okay, you guys ready to stop?
Yeah.
Three, two, one, stop.